Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome. With President Bush announcing an energy strategy for the nation, legislators and energy experts will step up the debate and search for new and better ways to generate energy. We'll take another look at hydropower. Also, Texas moves aggressively to deal with hazardous wastes. Governor Richards calls for a moratorium on new sites. Buck Wynn at the Water Commission says, though waste reduction needs to be improved, in the end, that will not be enough.
And I will say that we can't just build ourselves out of this crisis. We just can't build enough facilities to take care of that increase. So we're going to have an aggressive waste reduction program. But that isn't going to get us all the way there. And I think anybody that takes a realistic look at our waste generation numbers will have to agree with that.
The Environment Show is a national production of WAMC. It's made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Following her State of the State message early in February, Texas Governor Ann Richards sent a letter to the Texas Water Commission ordering an implementation of a temporary ban on the siting of new hazardous waste landfills in the state. Texas is the first in the Union, thus, to react in this way to the problem of hazardous waste disposal. We asked Buck Wynn, chairman of the Water Commission, charged with carrying out the governor's orders, to explain.
Well, the governor has heard out on the campaign trail a lot of concern from citizens who live in areas where hazardous waste disposal facilities have been proposed. Now, as you may or may not know, Texas is the largest hazardous waste generating state in the country. We generate more than any other state, and that's not surprising when you consider that we have 60% of the nation's chemical manufacturing capacity here in Texas, and about 25% of the nation's petroleum refining capacity, and a lot of other heavy industry primarily on our Gulf Coast. So we have to have facilities to dispose of the waste, and a lot of facilities have been proposed by private industry, and this is met with fierce opposition in the communities where these facilities are proposed to be located. So the governor asked us to place a moratorium on the permitting of these facilities for a while in order to give her an opportunity to make some proposals to the legislature. Now, she asked us to do it for 2 years, and we felt that we didn't have the legal authority to do that. So we basically called a halt to our permitting activities for a few months through June, with an option to extend through September, in order to give the legislature a chance to consider issues like what our capacity needs are going to be, what siting criteria should be changed, if any, and issues like that. So it's a temporary situation in Texas. We know we're going to need more hazardous waste management capacity, but the policymakers want to have an opportunity to review our current program, and we agreed to give them that opportunity.
Last September, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency changed the definition of what is considered hazardous waste. Suddenly, much more now comes under that title. Suddenly, much more needs special treatment. Already, Texas generates over 70 million tons of hazardous material each year. That amounts to about 200,000 tons a day. And according to Wynn, under the new EPA guidelines, this amount could be as high as four times as much. Even with a temporary ban, then, on the new facilities, what is going to happen?
I'm hopeful that once the legislature and the governor have had an opportunity to look in depth at the capacity issue, that they will give us the ability to actually speed up the permitting process for those facilities that are deemed necessary to take care of the waste that we generate here in Texas. We're committed to doing that. We don't feel that it's appropriate for us to ship our waste to some other state and have them take care of our problem. But I'm hopeful that the policymakers will see this as an issue and will address it. You can be sure that I'll be over at the Capitol urging them to do so.
Now, Mr. Wynn, you have advocated for building more landfills, expanding current ones, constructing new incinerators, and increasing the general overall capacity to handle hazardous waste. Of course, environmentalists and citizens alike who are addressing and are concerned about this problem, many have counterproposals. Many would like to see waste reduction programs put into place, not the construction of more landfills and more incinerators. What is your response to that as a means of addressing this growing issue?
Well, first of all, you need to know that I was the first environmental official in the country to call for setting a goal of 50% waste reduction by 1995. And so I think I'm firmly on record as believing that waste reduction is the most desirable means of dealing with hazardous waste, and it is our first priority. But having said that, and assuming that we accomplish that very ambitious goal here in Texas, we're still going to have more hazardous waste than we currently have the capacity to deal with. If we don't have an adequate hazardous waste management infrastructure, then what we're going to see is we're going, in addition to the economic impacts on businesses that are either going to relocate or that aren't going to expand here, creating jobs, we're going to see a lot of illegal dumping, a lot of unsafe waste management practices, the kinds of things that led us to the point where we now have 29 Superfund sites on the national priority list that we're spending $200 million taxpayer dollars to clean up. So I don't think that you can fairly argue that waste reduction is going to take care of this 2- to 4-fold increase in hazardous waste that we now have as a result of the change in the federal definition. It is an important part of our overall strategy, and I will say that we can't just build ourselves out of this crisis. We just can't build enough facilities to take care of that increase. So we're going to have an aggressive waste reduction program. But that isn't going to get us all the way there. And I think anybody that takes a realistic look at our waste generation numbers will have to agree with that.
Buck Wynn, chairman of the Texas Water Commission. The commission is responsible for overseeing environmental regulations relating to hazardous and solid waste and water quality. Texas will be studying new ways to deal with hazardous waste. We will monitor the debate. This is Bruce Robertson. The rainy season in California is drawing to a close with little to show for it. Snowfall amounts in the Sierra Mountains reportedly is only a fraction of what it should be. California is entering the fifth year of a severe drought. To deal with the problem, the State Water Project, charged with delivering water to municipal, industrial, and agricultural projects, has reduced to 0% the amount of water delivered to farmers, and soon will begin taking a look at all other contracts as well. The Bureau of Reclamation, the other body handling surface water in the state, has cut to 25% the water it delivers to agricultural contracts, and down to 75% for industrial and municipal concerns. In addition, many well water and aquifer supplies are also going dry. Recently, California Governor Wilson issued a suggestion that Californians voluntarily ration water, something that many communities are already doing, either voluntarily or by law. Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley is expected to endorse a plan by the City Council to put a ration on the amount city users take each month and to fine those who exceed that amount. California Congressman Calvin Dooley is a freshman Democrat representing the 17th District, an area from Bakersfield to Fresno. It is a region including the top three agricultural producing counties in the nation in terms of agricultural receipts.
The geography of California is such that on the valley floor, we stretch, you know, which stretches from Sacramento down to Bakersfield. The rainfall we receive is anywhere from 10, well, actually it even gets down to about 8 inches annually in the Bakersfield area, which is in the south, up to probably closer to 20 inches in Sacramento. Fresno, which is about the heart of the valley, receives an annual rainfall of about 12 inches, which, for all practical purposes, the rain that falls on the valley floor is insignificant. We are blessed with the Sierra Nevadas, which is basically, in most years, a gigantic reservoir, in that the snow that accumulates there and melts in the summer goes into our rivers and our lakes and reservoirs, which provide us water. That snowpack at this time is only expected to be just a little over 10% of what it is in a normal year. So that right, the last figure was 13% of normal, which, you know, is obviously just a devastating situation. And for anyone that's flown out from California just recently, as I did a couple days ago, you fly over the Tahoe Basin, and it's just basically brown. There was very little snow accumulated.
So how did this situation develop? You've talked about the decrease in percentage of rainfall and snowpack in the mountains. The water shortage is certainly brought on by this change of natural precipitation, but what other conditions have contributed to this? Have there been any, can you say, sort of almost a mismanagement of the current or present natural water reserves?
Well, you know, there's a, you know, when, you know, both the Bureau of Reclamation and the State Water Project, you had to make some decisions on, you know, how they can, you know, manage their water supplies. And basically they utilize a quantitative risk analysis. And you have to take a historical perspective on what your anticipated rainfall will be from year to year. And then you have to try to determine just what level of reserves is prudent to maintain. And in this instance, it's been difficult to maintain reserves as we entered into the fifth year of the drought. You know, there are some things that we need to do, and I think this drought should be, if anything, a call to arms, or you know, for us to develop a more aggressive water policy for the next century, and that we need to be looking at ways which we can be better conservers of water, and also to look in how we can find additional water storage facilities, and certainly give greater attention to the recharge of our underground aquifers, which in effect is is probably one of the most effective water reservoirs that we have in the Central Valley, California.
What are going to be some of the reactions, I guess, or the results for the rest of the nation, the supermarket shelves and the like, if this situation at least continues or doesn't make any sharp improvement?
Well, you know, California is produces over 50% of all the fresh fruit and vegetables consumed in the United States. And we're going to see, I think, a increase in price from a lot of the fresh fruits and vegetables. And what's also, this is being compounded by the freeze, which basically destroyed the entire citrus crop in California, too, or certainly the major part of it. So we're having basically a double whammy here with the freeze and the drought, which is going to contribute to higher food prices. You know, it's going to have a ripple effect also, in that, you know, in California, when you're going to see a large number of people which are going to be unemployed because of the lost employment opportunities as a result of the drought, that's going to have a ripple effect too. My district is already experiencing close to a 15% unemployment rate. That's more reflective of the freeze that we experienced, but we don't anticipate the situation improving much coming on into the summer months when the full effect of the drought manifests itself.
Finally, Congressman, even if rainfall and snowfall amounts in the mountains return to normal this spring, summer, and by next winter, that probably wouldn't make much of a dent immediately. We wouldn't see a reversal within a year of the drought situation. It would take some time to return.
And that's correct. We're actually in California, we're just about out of what is considered our rainy period. Almost all of our rainfall falls from December to March, with January being our wettest month, and we've cycled through we're into the last part of February, and we just have March, and then basically we don't anticipate or normally expect to get any rain through the balance of the year until next November. And then the situation has got to the point where it's going to take above average rainfalls for a number of years in order to recharge our reservoirs, and certainly to recharge our underground aquifers. You know, the consequences of this also go beyond, the agriculture arena, and certainly the businesses which rely upon them in the valley. But our national forests and parks are being dramatically impacted. There's an estimated 30% loss in the forest in the Tahoe Lake Tahoe Basin, and in the Sequoia and Sierra National Parks in my district, they're anticipating over 100 million board feet of lumber in each of those has been lost due to the drought. So, in fact, I was talking to one of the regional supervisors of the forest there just the other day, and he said that our annual timber yield out of there could be supplied without harvesting one green tree, that just by salvage operations we could generate all the timber that's needed basically for all the mills in the Central Valley of California.
Congressman Calvin Dooley, we thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
California Democratic freshman Congressman Calvin Dooley. Before coming to Congress this year, Dooley was a farmer in Southern California, specializing in cotton, alfalfa, and walnuts. This is Bruce Robertson. This spring, legislators in Washington will be grappling with a powerful issue: power, energy, from where and at what cost. Elaine Evans is executive director of the National Hydropower Association, an advocacy organization representing owners and operators in the legislative and regulatory process.
It's our oldest form of electricity. It's the safest form of electrical generation that we know of.
How much of the nation's total energy needs presently come from hydropower?
Hydro used for electrical generation, which is its primary activity, is around 10 to 12%.
And in megawatts, how much would that be?
It's around 88,000 megawatts.
And how about step down to kilowatts? I'll try to get a handle on how many, for example, how many private homes might be powered by this.
Oh, multi-millions of customers that are powered. I think 42% of the power in the West is hydro.
Now, the question follows on that is, that's how much we presently are using. How much could we be?
We could, in theory, double our hydro contribution and push it up to close to 25%. Realistically, we could add maybe 25,000 megawatts of power, which is the equivalent to 20 nuclear power plants, at existing dams by adding drain holes in the bottom of a lot of dams where we already have reservoirs and lakes and no powerhouses. So it is possible to add significant amounts of power at existing facilities. And we have a lot of undeveloped sites as well.
No, undeveloped meaning places where dams could be built?
Places where dams could be built, water could be diverted into streams. We also have the ability for off-stream pump storage for peaking, which means two reservoirs that are closed loop. And it's like having two washing machines, one on the top of the hill and the other on the bottom of the hill, and they just pump water back and forth up and down the hill instead of using gas or oil for that power we need at dinner time and in the early morning. They call that peaking power. We could use hydropower to pump those back up and down, give us that kind of supply.
All right, now, there are several questions that pop up that we've referred to right here that go under the heading of what are some of the roadblocks to developing further our nation's reliance on hydropower, and there are different categories, I suppose, technological roadblocks, political roadblocks, and environmental roadblocks, and you've touched on some of the possible routes we need to develop and build more dams. We can divert more rivers, and this pumping, the off-peak pumping procedure. Dams being built, many environmentalists will say, uh-uh.
Well, Mark Twain said, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over. Everybody wants water for their favorite activity. Some think that water should only be used for recreation, but they want the ratepayers to pay for it. One group of users wants hydro projects to dump millions of dollars worth of water over a dam, so a few of them can go rafting. You've got other groups who are concerned about nature who want the animals and the plants to have natural flooding. They believe that dams basically should not be used to protect people and property, even though people and property have been built on a floodplain in various areas. Dams will be built for flood protection and drinking water. The question is, should we put in a power facility to make use of what is already going to be done to the environment for other reasons? Our regulations that govern hydro are very complicated. It's more difficult to site a hydro facility than it is any other form of energy except nuclear. It may even be that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because everybody's competing. Everybody wants exclusive use of that water. We've got a balance. Our society may not be able to have it all. So as a society, we've got to develop a process that ensures that fixed-income elderly ratepayers are as well represented as young professional recreationalists who want to raft. So we have a process that right now doesn't do justice to all the voices of the public.
That touches on the political roadblocks to further developing hydropower as a major source. What would be some of the political roadblocks that you would like to see lifted?
Well, I think the issue politically is hard choices. We criticize politicians for not making hard choices. Nobody wants new development in their backyard. That's probably the single most critical political reality that we see here in Washington. We need a comprehensive national energy plan. We're at war today over oil. If we built new hydro plants here at home, maybe we wouldn't be fighting in a foreign country to get our energy. But those decisions are part of who is the public, who represents the public in the process. If you have Americans showing in a poll that they choose hydro, 42% first, that's their first choice for electrical generation, and yet individual projects get picked off one by one. It's like you can't see the forest for the trees.
The proposal and practice of pumping water during off-peak hours using another fuel, such as oil or gas, is not entirely without its problems, nor is it a perfect solution either. The question is, are we saving fossil fuels if we are burning them at nighttime instead of the day? Well, yes, says Evans.
In a utility system, you have a mix of generation, and a lot of those big power plants that are what we call baseload at nighttime can't be ratcheted down efficiently. So that power that's being made available to us during the daytime to run our hospitals and run our factories at nighttime can be very efficiently used to pump power up so that during the daytime you don't burn gas or oil for peaking. Gas or oil is what usually is used for peaking power, so that they use big baseload plants, coal and nuclear, to pump the water up at nighttime, and then it comes down on demand during those busy times of the day.
The political and environmental roadblocks to further development of hydropower are evident. What of technological blocks? Evan says the industry itself is rather mature. That is, we have the necessary hardware and know-how to pump water to make electricity.
However, environmental engineering is a fairly new science, and it's not very exact. So that the technological impediments really fall into, do we know what is really required for adequate habitat protection, adequate protection for the fisheries? And the industry has spent multi-millions of dollars a year on environmental protection. And we're spending that money to ensure that hydro projects are compatible with the needs of the environment in which they operate.
When evaluating hydro as a source for future power, officials generally acknowledge its importance to a point. Most energy experts believe that the nation's energy picture will be a composite one. Evans believes hydro has not gotten a fair shake because of a licensing procedure which requires hydro operators to pay costs up front, before the fact, so to speak, unlike, say, a nuclear or a coal-fired plant.
Once the other technologies start to pay their true environmental impact costs, then hydro, who's been paying all those costs up front and in today's dollars, when we level the playing field, then you will see people reevaluating the hydro option. Our licensing process takes 5 to 7 years. A utility planner doesn't have that kind of horizon in his planning. It's very difficult for utility commissions. They have not included all those extra costs of environmental damage into the price of some of the other technology electrical rates. As a result, hydro, you have to pay a lot of money up front. You build a project, it's a lot of concrete. But there's no cost for the fuel. And once these fuel costs start rising, hydro will come back into its own.
Elaine Evans, Executive Director of the National Hydropower Association, advocating for increased reliance on hydropower for our nation's energy needs. There are many problems, as you might expect and already know. Building a new facility often displaces people, wildlife, and plants. Again, the question, energy at what cost? This is Bruce Robertson.
And that is our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, drop us a line. It's The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. This has been a WAMC national production. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.